This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories of the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. And just ahead of the program, the battle of the retailers is on. I'm John Tucker in New York.
I'm Stephen Carroll in London, where the stakes are high for Chancellor Jeremy Hunt as he unveils a budget that must plug a massive fiscal gap and calm market fears about the UK economy.
I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong. We look at the most innovative ideas at the Bloomberg New Economy Forum in Singapore.
I'm Amy Morris in Washington, how the midterms could shape the 2024 presidential election.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, DAB Digital Radio London, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Hi, everybody. I'm John Tucker, and let's start today's program with the retail segment. Retailers sitting on massive amounts of inventory they overordered this year after being traumatized by pandemic supply chain shortages. And now, according to industry experts, including Dana Telsey, CEO of Telsey Advisory Group, inventory is sky high.
It's not only up versus last year, it's up versus 2019 also. Most companies are looking to reduce inventory levels.
And Telsey also tells us this massive glut of inventory comes just as the economy appears to be hitting a rough patch.
Certainly the middle and lower income levels are definitely spending more cautiously, and the stock market volatility, real estate values may also lead to some level of moderation in the upper income areas.
This could potentially put discount retailers in the sweet spot, although we just heard Telsey say their shoppers could be constrained. So joining us now to talk about this, Poonam Goyal, senior retail analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence. All right, what we just said, throw that into the blender, turn it on high, and what do we pour out? What's the outlook here?
The outlook is for the shoppers, they're going to get great deals this holiday.
Yeah, if they can afford it. I don't have any money left.
A deal's a deal. People still jump on deals. But seriously, on a serious note, holiday is going to be challenging this year. Retailers have a lot to chew on. Clearly, consumers are strapped for cash. They have a lot of inventory, which means that they'll be promotional across the board. They're still dealing with inflation, higher costs. So that's going to pressure margins. It won't be easy, but we do see shoppers returning to stores, which is a good thing. And online sales will still rise, but you're not going to see the double-digit gains that you're used to seeing for the past many years.
Specifically to TJ Maxx, they report quarterly results this coming week. So is this their moment in the sun because they're a discounter?
Yeah, TJX, you know, the one thing, inventory is bad for retail, but it's great for TJX and any off-pricers. When there's a lot of inventory in the marketplace, they get to buy it cheap and pass on those savings to their customers. So it just means they'll be getting better product. They save that product, they can put it out next year and make better margin on it. So you will find good stuff at TJX at a bargain, and we're going to see shoppers appreciate that and head to their stores. Keep in mind, their business is largely a store-based business, less than 2-3% done online.
Okay, this just occurs to me now, just sort of tangentially. Does the fact that there are high inventories mean that the supply chain disruptions, all that stuff is solved, it's all behind us now?
Yeah, I think it's a different hiccup in the supply chain. So remember last year at this point, we were talking about not getting enough inventory for the holidays. So retailers had ordered in advance, they had hoarded more than they needed, and all that inventory is coming into the stores, the distribution centers, as of spring, summer this year. So now all of a sudden they have so much inventory, right? It's almost a reverse problem, and they don't know where to keep it, they don't know how to stock it, they don't know how to sell it. Some of it is not sellable anymore because it's not seasonal. Some of that inventory from spring is coming in the fall. What do you do with that? You got to mark it down.
Okay. Let's move on to Amazon. You also cover Amazon. What's the story there?
Yeah, you know, Amazon is a company that we still like very much. They clearly are going through some issues right now, especially when it comes to rising costs and enterprises cutting back on spend. So they have multiple businesses. Online, clearly the biggest business, but the most profitable is their cloud business, AWS. What you saw last quarter was a function of what happened at AWS, which is why the stock took a beating. But from the online perspective, we do think that sales have bounced back from the first half, so they're much better than they were in 1H. And while there will be more discounting in the fourth quarter, we do think Amazon for the long run still stands to be in the best position to take online share, as a shift from brick and mortar to online is still very much on the table.
Okay. We also have Macy's, Gap, Walmart reporting this coming week.
You said this earlier, the consumer doesn't have money to spend, right? They have to find the money to spend. They're worried about costs rising. So promotions will be key, and how they discount and the inventory that they bring forward will really determine their top line and margins at the end of the quarter. Walmart, a value play, but it does target the low-end consumer. So that's the consumers that's probably most strapped for cash, and inflation will hurt their spending. Where Macy's is struggling with being a department store, right? We've talked about department stores in the past, and it's a place where consumers are going less today than they did years ago. So they're still challenged with those structural shopping challenges that consumers are shifting away from.
Okay, before you go, I ask this question every year of you. What's the to get item this year? What's the one item I have to buy for the holiday shopping season?
The PS5 is still on a lot of shoppers' wish list, so I think it's still
really?
Going to be electronics and toys. Electronics or toys are still at the top of wish list, and gift cards.
Okay,
people want gift cards.
Well, that's what I'll get you then. Poonam, always a pleasure. I appreciate it. Poonam Goyal, Senior Retail Analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence. And just to hit on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, Britain's finance minister will finally, officially unveil his budget. I'm John Tucker. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead of the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm John Tucker in New York. Up later in the program, busy time in Asia as we gear up for the Bloomberg New Economy Forum. But first, almost 3 weeks later than planned, Britain's finance minister will finally unveil his budget on Thursday. Jeremy Hunt, along with the prime minister, Rishi Sunak, need to balance the books and convince markets there won't be a repeat of the previous government's mistakes that sent gilt markets into meltdown. And for more, let's head to London and bring in Bloomberg Daybreak Europe anchor Stephen Carroll.
John, Jeremy Hunt might have been spooked by the Halloween date his budget was originally set for, but in the coming days he might get a chance to scare us all anyway with the gloomy economic outlook that the UK is facing. We've been well warned the situation is grim, the Bank of England's forecasting 18 months of recession, and the fiscal gap that needs to be plugged in this budget is estimated at more than £30 billion. To look ahead to what's in store, I'm joined by our UK correspondent Lizzie Burden. Lizzie, set the scene for us. It's been called an autumn statement, but it's a pretty wintry backdrop.
Our colleague Catherine Griffiths has reported that the Chancellor told a group of senior business people that this would be really interesting bleep if he wasn't in the middle of it. You've got double-digit inflation, strikes across sectors, and the Bank of England forecasting a recession, though how deep it's going to be is going to depend on how high interest rates will rise. Now, the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt and the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak have made very clear there are eye-wateringly difficult decisions ahead if they want to plug this hole in the public finances. Some would say that hole isn't real, it doesn't have to be plugged, but you'll remember the market turmoil that followed Liz Truss's mini-budget in September, in large part due to the raft of unfunded tax cuts that she and her Chancellor then Kwasi Kwarteng proposed. But the bottom line is they need to boost growth, help the most vulnerable people through the cost of living crisis without adding to inflation.
I want to tackle this idea of how much information we're getting in advance of the budget as well. In the run-up to Thursday's announcement, there's been a plethora of reports in the media about what sorts of measures we might be getting. This is something, Lizzie, that you and I discussed with Panmure Gordon's chief economist, Simon French. He's very against the way these leaks are happening and says that it has a visible chilling effect on UK economic activity.
There are areas that are sensitive to changing tax rates, changing funding for infrastructure projects. This run-up to every fiscal event does move activity to the right. Now, you could say that's only for a couple of weeks, but this stuff is, if you like, symptomatic of a broader malaise that has overtaken UK politics, in my view, which is this rotating door between the special advisor community and the journalist community, and they're all trying to keep each other happy by leaking stories. This leak culture up ahead of a fiscal event has real world implications that I do think if you're in the Westminster bubble, it's you sometimes lose sight of.
Okay, so that's the view of Simon French from Panmure Gordon when he spoke to us a couple of days ago. Lizzie, that's Simon's point of view on that issue. Of course, we're very keen to see what sort of things are being floated. What are the controversial ideas that are being batted around at the moment?
Well, first off, Simon's not wrong. Business leaders are frustrated by all the leaks, especially about potential tax rises on dividends and capital gains, because they do have real-world consequences for investment in cash-hungry startups. The way the former Pizza Express boss put it, Hugh Osmond, was it's as if every day they set a new hair running. He said it's lazy, it's laden with unintended consequences. So that's the comms. In terms of the meat of the budget, some measures that you could see would be an increased windfall tax on energy profits, which would be extended in terms of time from 2026 to 2028 and expanded to include energy generators. That would upset Tories who think that the state shouldn't punish business for success. You could also see a freeze on the foreign aid budget. That's going to invite criticism that the UK is abandoning its ambitions as a world leader. And then there's the thorny issue of whether to raise pensions and benefits in line with inflation. But if you look at who Rishi Sunak's appointed as pensions secretary, Mel Stride, he's expressed that he thinks they should rise in line with inflation, and he's a key Sunak ally.
And lots of difficult decisions being made as well. Now, this statement will also be a chance for Rishi Sunak's government to set out some of its priorities for the economy. Plenty of industries very interested in what's going to be said. One that we'll be listening closely is the financial sector, very key to the City of London. We've been talking to Miles Selleck about this. He's from the industry group, the City UK.
Reflecting the conversations that we've had with international counterparts and other potential investors in the UK, what people are looking for is stability. They're looking for predictability. I think the UK has been seen from a political perspective as just a little bit too exciting, certainly since 2016 and the Brexit vote and the sort of consequences that have flowed from that, and arguably from 2014 and the Scottish independence referendum. So I think there will be a strong sense of welcome for being able to know the direction of travel on regulation, what that looks like now that the UK is out of the European Union, what's the vision for financial and related professional services, something Rishi Sunak set out quite compellingly in his Mansion House speech last year. How will that be built on? And what are we going to see as we move forward also in terms of potential new deals with other markets?
Okay, so that's Miles Selleck from the City UK. That's one form of perhaps pressure that the government will be feeling. It hasn't been a very easy start to Rishi Sunak's premiership either, and this could potentially be an important moment politically as well. Talk to us about the politics. Could this be a reset moment perhaps for the new government?
I'm sure Rishi Sunak would hope to draw a line between himself and Liz Truss, given that he spent the whole summer warning what would happen if tax cuts were launched too soon without dealing with the immediate problem of inflation. He too is going to need to boost growth in the medium to long term if he wants to be re-elected in 2024. But he needs to do that without adding to inflation. In fact, the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt has said that he wants to help bring down inflation so that the Bank of England can raise rates as little as possible to minimise the recession the UK faces. Now, Hunt and Sunak are being accused of managing Britain's decline, being too pessimistic about UK growth. And you could say that the Bank of England's messaging has been too excessively gloomy. The banks forecast this long recession if rates follow market expectations. But that nuance was seemingly lost on most of the national newspapers. So you have to ask whether the man in the street is going to be too gloomy as a result of the messaging outside the Bank of England. Likewise with the Treasury, economists are asking whether the Treasury is going to raise taxes and cut spending too much in order to leave itself headroom in case growth Ruth underwhelms, so that it has enough left in the kitty for pre-election giveaways. And the question really is the Treasury creating unnecessary pain?
One of the many, many questions we'll be hoping to get answers to on Thursday when the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt takes to his feet to deliver the autumn statement. Thanks to our correspondent Lizzie Burden for those insights. I'm Stephen Carroll in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. John?
Stephen, thanks a lot. Just ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, global leaders gathering in Asia for the Bloomberg New Economy Forum. I'm John Tucker. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York. Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C. Bloomberg 991. To Boston. Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco. Bloomberg 960. To the country. Sirius XM Channel 119. To London. DAB Digital Radio. And around the globe. The Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend.
John Tucker in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. Movers and shakers gathering in Asia. We have the G20 meeting taking place in the coming days in Bali, Indonesia. And U.S.-China relations also in focus there. We also have another big gathering in Asia just about underway. And for more on that, let's go to Hong Kong and Bloomberg Daybreak Asia host Brian Curtis and his colleague Doug Krisner.
John, the fifth annual Bloomberg New Economy Forum gets underway in the coming week in Singapore. It comes at a delicate time for the global economy.
Inflation is at a 40-year high in many countries. We know that war continues to rage in Ukraine, and food security is very much in question.
It's in question because food supplies are dwindling and costs are skyrocketing. Supply chains have been broken and output has been crippled by labor shortages. Policymakers and investors are looking for innovative ideas to break the chain.
And as such, the forum comes at a very opportune time. Joining us now, Bloomberg's Eric Schatzker, who is in Singapore for the forum. Eric, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for helping us set the stage for this year's NEF. Let's begin with a view from 30,000 feet, so to speak. New economy, big picture, no doubt. And I imagine that a lot of this is going to focus on the intersection between government and the private sector. Can you touch upon some of the key themes up for discussion?
I would say that one theme we will be tackling in earnest and absolutely cannot ignore is the rising tension level between the United States and China. And of course, this isn't a new story. The tension level has been rising for some time. But with President Xi having cemented control over the Chinese Communist Party at the recent Congress, and the Biden administration having imposed new controls on the export of advanced technology to China, this situation has been thrown into perhaps sharper relief than we've seen it in maybe since the early 1970s. Because it casts a shadow over everything in this part of the world.
Yeah.
And
well, you know,
it's just simply impossible to ignore.
You're right. And it's interesting that you mentioned that it's been with us because you remember even the first one. We were supposed to do the first NEF in Beijing. And it had to get switched to Singapore. And we went to Singapore for that first one. So U.S.-China relations has tended to intervene, really, even back in that time when Donald Trump was waging his sort of trade war with China. But there's some other big issues that weigh in as well. Inflation, I'm thinking that inflation could be having a big impact as well on companies trying to deal with, say, setting targets for carbon reduction and for spending in green technologies and such. And this makes it a very difficult time to outlay a lot of capital.
Oh, it certainly does. It's a very delicate time. It's one of the themes that we will be exploring at the New Economy Forum with some of the world's largest and most powerful investors. I would name among them Khaldun Al-Mubarak from Mubadala, which is, of course, the Emirati Sovereign Wealth Fund. We also have Neil Shen, who is the founder and CEO, effectively, of Sequoia, or the managing partner, excuse me, of Sequoia China, one of the world's foremost venture capital investors. We have Lim Chow Kiat, who is the CEO of GIC, which is the Singaporean, one of the two Singaporean sovereign wealth funds. John Graham from the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board. Raphael Arndt from the Future Fund of Australia, yet another sovereign wealth fund. These are the capital pools that have to make decisions right now about how much they're willing to plow into renewable energy and sustainability and the pressures that inflation is creating for the rest of the world is having real consequences for those investment decisions. What we're hoping to find out at the New Economy Forum is that some of these sovereign wealth pools remain committed to making investments in carbon reduction, for example, and renewable energy, because if they falter, then there's a good chance that we could throw net zero by 2050 out the window.
Well, the timing of the NEF is such that it so closely follows COP27, and I'm curious to hear about the momentum that may be building in the community that you just described here. Is there greater appetite in the investment community for opportunities in the green space now? Is there some enthusiasm building?
You know, I would say, Doug, that yes, it's as much of an imperative as ever before, but it's a much more complicated and challenging picture because of the macroeconomic headwinds. And it's not just inflation, it's the consequences of inflation, not just rising prices, but
higher interest rates. The hurdle
is so much higher now.
A lot of fodder for interesting conversation, no doubt. Eric, thank you so much for being with us and helping us set the stage for the 5th annual Bloomberg New Economy Forum. Bloomberg's Eric Schatzker joining us from Singapore. I'm Doug Krisner, along with Brian Curtis in Hong Kong. You can catch us weekdays here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 7 a.m. in Hong Kong, 6 p.m. on Wall Street. John.
Brian and Doug, thanks a lot. Just ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, what to watch for in the coming week and weeks as we move closer to the 2024 presidential campaigns. I'm John Tucker. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm John Tucker in New York. Lots of surprises in the midterms and some rancor between former President Trump and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, too. Trump last week lashing out at his potential competitors in the 2024 presidential race.
Trump at 71, Ron DeSanctimonious at 10%, Mike Pence at 7. Oh, Mike's doing better than I thought.
That's sort of the stage setter mood-wise when it comes to Republicans in the post-midterm world. For more about all of it, including how things are stacking up for Democrats in 2024 as well, let's head to our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington and Amy Morris. Amy.
All right. Thank you, John. And joining me now, Bloomberg Government Senior Elections Reporter Greg Giroux. Greg, you've been following this very closely with momentum for President Biden, and he's talking now a little more about 2024. There's also been some disarray among Republicans. They say they'll be able to work some of it out. Let's start from the very beginning. Ron DeSantis claiming this huge victory in the gubernatorial race down in Florida. Let's hear what he had to say, and we'll talk about it on the other side.
We offer a ray of hope that better days still lie ahead.
All right, so Ron DeSantis talking about some of the traction that he's got. How much does he really have to play with here?
Well, he was a big winner from Tuesday and was otherwise a good overperformance by Democrats and underperformance by Republicans around the country. DeSantis was reelected by 19 percentage points in Florida, which is a very stunning margin in a state that not too long ago was seen as the quintessential swing state. It was the biggest win by a Florida gubernatorial candidate since 1982, and DeSantis was winning areas like Miami-Dade County in South Florida, heavily Hispanic area. He was winning Palm Beach County, a very Democratic-leaning county. So this is a big win for DeSantis, and given that he's a Republican governor in a state that will have 30 electoral votes in the 2024 election, if he can help lock down Florida for Republicans, he'll be at the top, if not near the top, of Republican preference voters for the 2024 election, if one Donald J. Trump does not run.
Well, that was what I was going to ask about, because it almost sounds as though DeSantis could be dethroning Donald Trump, at least when it comes to who is the kingmaker in the GOP, because there were plenty of Trump-backed candidates on Tuesday who did not win.
That's right. Trump did not have a good election night on Tuesday. Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania lost a key Senate race to John Fetterman. And in some key House races, some Trump-aligned candidates lost districts that maybe other Republican candidates would have held. So Trump does not look good coming out of this election, although he is, it seems clear he's likely to run for a third time for president. The big question will be, does Ron DeSantis run against him in the Republican primary? If you look at Republican preference polls, it's Trump and DeSantis, and then there's a big fall off with everyone else. We didn't see a one-on-one race against Trump in 2016. He benefited somewhat by the divided Republican opposition, but will we see a one-on-one race between Trump and DeSantis? We'll probably find out not too long from now.
I'm wondering if this also helps to embolden other Republican candidates who might be looking at the White House. I'm thinking of Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. He is, of course, the outgoing governor of Maryland, but he has also indicated, hey, look at how these midterms turned out. It seems as though there might be some room for me in the Republican Party.
Yes, it'll be interesting to see which Republicans who've wanted to be president or considered becoming president, or at least running for that office, will decide to at least do the early spade work that candidates often do, like traveling to Ohio and New Hampshire and contributing to candidates. One critic of Trump who has run for president before and who donated to Republican candidates late in the campaign, I noticed, was former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. He was very critical of Trump after Tuesday's election results. So if Trump doesn't run, I think all bets are off about who gets in. I think it'd be a free-for-all. But I think I am also wondering who other Republicans besides Ron DeSantis, who's mentioned frequently in the presidential sweepstakes, what other Republicans would decide to run against Trump should the ex-president make that third bid for president, as he seems likely to do.
Yeah, I'm wondering about that, too, if this indicates that perhaps he would not be the choice for the GOP to run for the White House. At the same time, would this be an opportunity for people to sort of hang on to those coattails, maybe a vice presidential bid? Because he has also indicated that Pence won't be his running mate.
Pence certainly won't be his running mate, and you want to look for maybe the next generation of Republican leaders. So we'll see who that when the smoke clears after we get final results from the 2022 election, who might be in the running for president and vice president in 2024.
And we are talking about how the midterms may have shaped the general election. We are talking with Bloomberg Government senior elections reporter Greg Giroux. I want to shift over, Greg, to the Democratic side, turning our attention now to California Governor Gavin Newsom. After the polls closed on election night, he spoke at a watch party at the Citizen Hotel in Sacramento.
We have a responsibility as Californians to do more about what we did tonight, to continue to assert our values, which we hold dear. We believe they're American values, certainly California values.
Now, does he, Greg, have a clearer path to the Democratic presidential nomination than maybe DeSantis does on the Republican side? Like, how does that break down?
I don't think he has a clearer path than DeSantis, if only because I think Joe Biden is clearly going to run for re-election again. And maybe the overperformance by Democrats in the midterm election may tamp down whatever chatter that may be out there, floating out there about would Biden run again or not, or if he would be challenged in the primary. I don't expect Gavin Newsom to challenge Joe Biden in the Democratic primaries in 2024. But you know, Gavin Newsom is the governor of what would be the fourth largest economy in the world, about the size of Germany. And so just like the governor of Florida, you'd think the governor of a large state like California, just being the chief executive of a huge state with a huge economy, would be automatically mentioned in presidential sweepstakes. It's been a while since we've had the California governor mentioned as a possible presidential candidate. You know, Jerry Brown had already run, what, three times when he was governor for the second time. Arnold Schwarzenegger was ineligible to run. Gray Davis was too unpopular. Pete Wilson probably too moderate to win the Republican presidential nomination. And, you know, not too long before that, you had Ronald Reagan, who used the California governorship to launch himself to the presidency. So Gavin Newsom, I think, is going to be mentioned as a potential presidential candidate, if not in 2024, maybe in 2028, if only because he is the chief executive of what would be the fourth or fifth largest economy in the world, a $3.5 trillion economy.
Is that, though, Greg, one of the issues that faces the Democratic Party right now? You have someone like Joe Biden that not all Democrats are 100% in love with having Joe Biden run again. And at the same time, the next guy who may be in line, the next sort of heir apparent, and I'm using air quotes here, would be Gavin Newsom, who doesn't really have a shot against somebody like Joe Biden. Is that the issue, that they're looking for the leadership that they haven't quite found yet? They don't have a Bill Clinton, they don't have a Barack Obama?
Right. I think in the Democratic circles, in the Democratic Party, certainly with when it comes to the presidency and also for congressional leadership, you have, you know, Joe Biden, you have Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, James Clyburn, who have been around for some time. And there's clearly a lot of pent-up ambition in Democratic circles about who is going to be in that next vanguard of Democratic Party leadership. So not just for Congress, but for the presidency as well. Yes, I mean, we can't escape the fact that Joe Biden will be almost 82 years old by the time of the 2024 election. But I think Democrats would welcome a rematch between Biden and Donald Trump if Trump decides to run again, as it looks like he will. Then I think, you know, who's going to be in the next group of future Democratic leaders who would run for president. I think maybe you look at the 2022 midterm election results and you look at which governors were elected for the Democrats. Gretchen Whitmer was reelected in Michigan, a key swing state. So I think you probably look there at who won key governorships and maybe even key U.S. Senate races in 2022.
Well, let me ask you about some of the strategy. I want to pick your brain. If you were a political strategist, Greg, would you recommend to former President Trump to not make that announcement that he will be running again? You know, he's been teasing for a while now that he's going to make this big announcement on November 15th, but that was before there was going to be this runoff for the Senate in Georgia. And there may be some concern about sort of sucking all the air out of the room if he makes that announcement while that's going on. What would you recommend?
Yeah, as a political strategist, if I were aligned with Trump, I might recommend the ex-president to hold off.
Before I let you go, I want to talk to you a little bit about the historical implications and what we saw over this past week with the midterms. To me, just somebody who's covered this sort of on a superficial level for decades, this seems like a really unusually intense and raucous midterm. I want to know what you think about it and why is it in this place in history?
Well, this midterm was really extraordinary. It was actually a pretty good overperformance by the White House's party. In midterm elections, you have more of the energy and enthusiasm tends to lie with the opposition party. And in midterm elections, since the end of World War II, the average result has been the White House's party losing an average of 26 seats in the House. It's going to be one of the most closely divided U.S. houses in history.
In American history.
Yes.
All right, Greg, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on this. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bloomberg Government Senior Elections Reporter Greg Giroux. That's what's going on in the nation's capital. For more of our political news coverage, tune in to Balance of Power with David Westin weekdays at noon Wall Street time and Sound On with Joe Matthew weekdays at 5 p.m. Wall Street time right here on Bloomberg Radio. I'm Amy Morris, and this is Bloomberg. John.
Amy Morris reporting from our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington. Amy, thanks a lot. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 a.m. Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm John Tucker, and this is Bloomberg.